Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The U.S. Senate passes a $1 trillion spending bill and a collision in the waters of the Suez. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. The U.S. Congress has given final approval to a massive $1.1 trillion government spending plan for most of 2015, ending a threat the federal government could shut down again if the legislation was not passed. The measure passed late Saturday by a vote of 56 to 40. Senator Patrick Leahy.
On the motion to concur in the House amendment to the Senate amendment, H.R. 83, the yeas are 56, the nays are 40. The motion to concur is passed.
There was last-minute politicking with Majority Leader Harry Reid using the deadline to push through a slew of Mr. Obama's nominees for administration jobs and appointees for judicial positions who had had a much more difficult time winning approval in January after Republicans take control of the Senate. Egyptian officials say a fishing boat collided with another watercraft in the Gulf of Suez, killing at least 11 fishermen. Security officials say the dead men were pulled from the water today, with another 18 men still missing. The Associated Press says the fishing boat collided with a Panama-flagged container ship carrying 220,000 tons of cargo from an Italian port. Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir is claiming victory over the International Criminal Court after the court's prosecutor suspended investigation of alleged war crimes in Darfur. Speaking in Khartoum on Saturday, Mr. Bashir said the Sudanese people defeated the ICC by refusing to hand over to Sudanese officials to what he called colonial courts. He says the court has admitted that it failed in its effort against him. ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda said Friday she has no choice but to hibernate investigative activities in the case. This is VOA News. A string of Taliban attacks in Afghanistan have killed at least 22 people, including two American soldiers. Insurgent violence is spiking as most international combat forces prepare to leave the country at the end of this month. VOA's Ayaz Ghul has details.
Afghan authorities say a suicide bomber detonated his explosive Saturday near a bus carrying local soldiers in Kabul. The powerful blast destroyed the vehicle and killed at least 7 personnel on board, while wounding at least 10 others, including civilians. Meanwhile, authorities in the southern Helmand province reported that Taliban gunmen riding motorbikes shot dead 12 mine-clearing workers and wounded many others. Also, a U.S. defense official was reported Saturday as saying that a bomb attack on a NATO convoy north of Kabul killed two American soldiers the previous night. Insurgent violence has spiked as most international combat forces prepare to leave the country on December 31st. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
After late-night wrangling at a United Nations climate conference in Peru, negotiators early today reached a deal setting a stage for a global climate pact in Paris next year. The Lima Agreement was adopted after earlier drafts were rejected by developing countries who accused rich nations of shirking their responsibilities to fight global warming and pay for its impacts. The final draft alleviated those concerns with language saying countries have common but differentiated responsibilities in dealing with global warming. Countries are to submit national plans on dealing with climate change for consideration ahead of next December's summit in Paris. A U.S. citizen has appeared at a news conference in the North Korean capital of Pyongyang to denounce U.S. domestic and foreign policy and its human rights record.
My name is Arturo Pierre Martinez. I am a 29-year-old citizen, a U.S. citizen born and raised in the city of El Paso in the state of Texas. I have taken up a risky journey to the DPRK so that I could pass along some very valuable and disturbing information. I felt its government would appreciate it.
It's not clear how Mr. Martinez from Texas got into North Korea or whether he'll be allowed to leave the country, but his mother told CNN her son is bipolar and that he went to China in November after being released from a psychiatric hospital. Tens of thousands of people rallied in New York, Washington, and other U.S. cities on Saturday in protest of police killings of unarmed black men and youth and to call for local law enforcement reforms.
No justice!
No peace!
No justice!
No peace!
What do we want?
Relatives of Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, and Trayvon Martin, four people killed in incidents over the past 2 years, took part in the Washington, D.C. event labeled the Justice for All March. Several thousand protesters marched down Pennsylvania Avenue toward the U.S. Capitol building, carrying signs, some proclaiming Black Lives Matter. They certainly do in this country. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Well, there's no pending charge in any court of law in Uganda against him. And that could largely mean that they will not charge him because they have had a whole year to do so.
Questions are being asked about a renegade Ugandan army general's decision to return home from exile. We'll have details.
The president very early in the day had called on all politicians and all professional politicians that, look, this challenge requires the cooperation of all Nigerians.
Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan vows to win the war in Toro.
We made a public disclosure that usually in this time of the year, this is the time we have celebrations.
And Sierra Leone bans all public celebrations during Christmas. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Ugandan renegade army general David Sejusa is seeking to be discharged from the army following his return from exile, according to his attorney Ladislaw Rakafuzi. He went into exile after demanding an investigation into an assassination plot linked to President Yoweri Museveni's alleged succession plan, under which the president will step down and hand over power to his son. Mr. Rakafuzi told me that the renegade army general wants to become a civilian and do what civilians normally do.
Yes, he arrived at 3:14 aboard the DA. So he reached the airport. He was welcomed at a VIP by the head of internal security organization. I was in that place in the VIP together with the sister of Nifula. So all of us welcomed him back home.
Being his attorney, you knew some of the challenges and the circumstances under which he left the country. Some people say that his life was in danger. Why now?
Well, there's no pending charge in any court of law in Uganda against him. And that could largely mean that they will not charge him because they have had a whole year to do so. They will extradite him from the UK if they wanted. If there were any pending charges in Uganda, but they didn't. So my reading of the situation is that there are no really pending charges against him. But there were those zealous people who made all sorts of statements, shall arrest him, shall take him to court. All these things were said, but there's nothing in writing. The government works on paper in black and white. It does not talk, it does not act through threats on the press and that kind of thing. So we go with the situation as it is now. He's back, and they would have arrested him, say, yesterday when he arrived at the airport. They didn't. And this morning, the president of Ghana has been trying to get him security and actually asked him to choose his own people who will give him security. So my feel of things is that he's back home.
Attorney Rakafuzi, if I heard you right, General Sejusa complained before he left that his security was threatened. He feared for his life. He even wrote at some point that some of his family members were targeted. Are you therefore saying that the president assured him of security and has provided him with some form of protection for him to even select people who can protect him? Is this the case?
Yes, that is true. That's the case.
What is next now that he has returned as his lawyer? What is next?
He has told me that as soon as possible, he wants to be discharged from the army so that he is a civilian and he is free to do the things a civilian does.
So he still remains a senior official in the army as we speak now?
Yeah, that is true. Because I've never been discharged formally from the army.
So when is he likely to formally apply to be discharged from the army?
I don't know, but the last time I talked to his sister around 5 hours ago, he was still resting, having arrived at Simbabwe very actually this morning, and Before then, I've been on the jet plane, which with the whole that jet lag, so was resting.
Ladislaw Rakafuzi is the attorney for a Ugandan Renegade Army General, David Sejusa. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan has promised that his administration will win the war on terror. This despite what he describes as efforts by some individuals to sabotage efforts to combat Islamist militant group Boko Haram. Mr. Jonathan was recently confirmed as the presidential candidate for the ruling People's Democratic Party, or PDP, ahead of the February general election. Critics say he doesn't deserve a second term in office because he has not ended the violence perpetrated by Boko Haram. But presidential spokesman Rubin Abati told me that the criticisms are politically motivated.
The president very early in the day had called on all politicians and all professional politicians that, look, this challenge requires the cooperation of all Nigerians. It requires a bipartisan approach because terrorism poses a threat to the sovereignty of our country. But in spite of that, you still find quite a number of politicians, particularly politicians in the opposition, are trying to use the problem of terrorism to play politics. Oftentimes, they even sound as if they are encouraging the terrorists to continue to attack the Nigerian state. And that, of course, is clearly a case of sabotage.
The question then becomes, why wouldn't the president ascertain those who are enabling this act, those who are sabotaging government effort, and name them so Nigerians will know who is helping to create the instability, the insecurity?
Well, government is engaged in an ongoing war against the terrorists. I mean, the terrorists, whoever they may be, you can see that there is a military operation going on against them. And the security forces have been having the upper hand, even in spite of some of the sensational headlines that you get to read. So those are the original saboteurs. And government has made it very clear that there will be no hiding place for anybody who wants to sabotage the Nigerian state. As for, other persons who may be encouraging them, wherever it is established that anybody has acted in a way that amounts to aiding and abetting, there is even an existing law, the Terrorism Act. Such behavior is criminalized. And there are persons who have been brought before the law, either civilians or military officials. I give you the example of the various soldiers who have been court-martialed. There have been reports of soldiers, deserting their posts upon the approach of the Boko Haram. Now that in itself is an act of sabotage, is an act of indiscipline, and the military authorities have shown that kind of behavior in the war front, to use that word, advisedly, will not be condoned by the security authorities.
Now, the president has been confirmed as the presidential candidate of the ruling PDP party ahead of next February's general election. How confident is the president of winning this battle, especially in the face of criticisms leveled against him, including incompetence, including being weak? How confident is he of winning?
The president is confident and is appreciative of the support that he has received from members of his party and from Nigerians generally. Whatever the opposition says, you must understand that this is a political season. In a political season, all kinds of things will be said. It's just political rhetoric. What nobody can deny is that President Jonathan is running on the record of his own performance. He is running on the record of his own achievements. And that was why in his acceptance speech on November 11, he made it very clear that he will campaign on the basis of facts and truth. He will campaign on the basis of issues and ideas. He will not campaign on the basis of emotions, just empty rhetoric, or the kind of empty promises that the opposition seems to have, acquired professionalism in. So that all that talk about, President Jonathan being this, being that, you need to contextualize it. You need to trace the source. It's just campaign talk.
As the incumbent, How confident are you that the Electoral Commission, the Independent National Electoral Commission, INEC, will administer a credible and transparent vote next year?
Well, the truth of the matter is that the Independent National Electoral Commission has discharged itself honorably, has acquitted itself honorably in the various elections that it has organized, the 2011 general elections, all the by-elections since then, all the gubernatorial elections since then. There is nothing to indicate that we have issues in terms of the credibility and integrity of the Electoral Commission. And don't forget that one of the major selling points of this administration is President Jonathan's commitment to free and fair elections, to the policy of what he describes as one man, one vote, one woman, one vote, one youth, one vote. And he has remained very consistent on this call.
Rumi Nabati is the spokesman for Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan. A spokesman for the Sierra Leonean government says banning of all public celebrations during Christmas festivities is part of the administration's effort to contain the Ebola outbreak. Abdullahi Barete says security agencies, including the police and the army, will enforce the nationwide ban beginning on December 20. Barete told me that the new measure has drawn support from citizens who, he says, are already buying food supplies for the Christmas period.
We made a public disclosure that usually in this time of the year, this is the time we have celebrations. This is the time a lot of marriages will happen. This is the time a lot of masquerades will be done all over the country. And amidst the Ebola virus we are containing, we don't want to reverse the gains we have been making over the past, particularly 10 days, with the numbers fluctuating between 58, 37, 27, etc. So that is why we have already consulted with the experts that we should whip up the campaign of people avoiding body contact as a way of mitigating the further spread and infection of new cases. So that is why we have decided as a government that we needed to announce these public measures. And already, some other districts in the country are even doing what we call clustered quarantining voluntarily. Some districts like Kono, some districts like Potsloko, some districts like Tonkolili, they have decided that effective last week, vehicles are not entering or leaving those areas at all. This is all measures being put to feed into the national Ebola response plan of mitigating the spread of virus through new infections.
Isn't this another round of anti-Ebola curfews or quarantine or lockdown, if you may, that the government implemented a couple of months back?
Well, for us, though, we believe, and you must know, Sierra Leone is one of the most tolerant countries when it comes to respecting religion. That is why we have even said in the past, since the president proclaimed the public state of emergency last July, that no public gathering should be promoted. But yet still people go to the church and they provide sermons. And they also promote body contact messages out people can avoid them. So which means on Christmas Day, people can still go to the church. We are working with the Interreligious Council of Sierra Leone so that they can promote best practices that will avoid people interacting unnecessarily. And this is where we think the only focus here is we don't want masquerades. We don't want those normal festivities as if we are in a normal situation. For us, and so far, the message has been received very well by the public. In fact, we received a lot of phone calls, text messages, commending the government for such a decision. Because particularly in the Western area, where we are recording spikes of new cases on a daily basis, compared to the rest of the country, it has been a welcome idea so far.
Now, when will this banning or this new measure be implemented? Exactly when will it begin?
Well, a it's going to be on the eve of Christmas, around the 20th. Some people have already going to the shops because we dispatch people to see how many people are interacting, going to do the shopping. So as of today, when the announcement was made yesterday, a lot of people have already started stockpiling foodstuff and other essential commodities so that they can avoid the rush come to the few days towards Christmas. So we're expecting that effective around the 20th or so, people will start to respect that. They must limit the interaction in public places because we have already come to a conclusion that the security apparatus will be deployed all over the country, which included the police and the military, so that we make sure that there is compliance.
Now, who is it, the police or for that matter, will there be all other security agencies teaming up with the police to enforce this ban?
Absolutely. Already we have a deployment of security forces all over the country. But what we are now going to do is those that are on standby for that particular festivities around this period, melting up to the New Year's, we are going to beef up security just to make sure while the police are enforcing it, they are also there to maintain the general peace and security of the country. And, of course, the military will be complementing their efforts as well just to make sure people can still recognize the festivities, but in a very modest way without interfering with the measures being put in place by the Ministry of Health and Sanitation towards mitigating the spread of the Ebola virus disease.
Abdoulaye Barete is a spokesman for the Sierra Leonean government. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. The Kenyan parliament is about to pass a controversial bill allegedly aimed at enabling the authorities' capacity to deal with terrorism and security issues. The Security Laws Amendment Bill, according to Human Rights Watch, goes against both African and international norms and standards on pre-trial detention, access to justice and fair trials. There are also concerns about right to privacy, the freedoms of assembly, expression and information. David Ohito is the digital editor at the Standard Media Group. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him in Nairobi to find out the reaction to this bill.
It's really a very sad turning point for this country, a country that has enjoyed a lot of entrenched democracy in the recent years since 1990 when the multipartyism was enacted and quite a number of democratic gains made. So it's come as a shocker to keen observers who have been monitoring the going on in Kenya over that period. More importantly, yes, Kenya has been a very strong victim of terror attacks and a target where several dozens of people have been killed in recent weeks. But that is not enough to address the problem of terrorism using very draconian laws, which will take away the gains made on freedom and democracy. The people on the streets, there are two sets of people. One, people who have been seeing how Kenya enjoyed democracy after the dictatorship under the KANU regime. And those also who really fought, got out to the trenches to fight for the gains that they had. Those people are very unhappy and are complaining very bitterly that they cannot allow to see Kenya rolling back to those dark days. Then there's a lot, of course, political fanatics of the current regime who always feel anything published by the government, any law proposed by the government, should be endorsed. And remember, Kenya is a deeply divided country, divided down the middle as per election, 50% with the opposition, 50% with the government. So that is the kind of situation that we're experiencing. And I don't think they have any trust on the members of parliament to do anything other than rubber stamp it, as they have done in recent past.
There was a very heated debate on Thursday with the opposition saying the law would infringe on basic human rights. Now the bill goes to the parliamentary committee for amendment. Do you think it will pass and be passed into law?
Yes, the current parliament that we have can never be trusted in terms of democratic laws. We have seen them pass very bad laws seeking to cap NGOs. We have seen parliament publish very retrogressive laws trying to curb human rights gains. restoring police shoot to kill orders. We've seen the same parliament passing two laws which targeted the media particularly so that the media can be muzzled. What else can you expect such out of such a parliament in less than 12 months? The best it can do is rubber stamp the draconian retrogressive laws, something this current parliament has been known for since it was elected.
David, this bill, among other requirements, requires journalists to obtain police permission before investigating or publishing stories on domestic terrorism and security issues. What an impact could this have on the media in Kenya?
It will seriously impede the rights and freedoms of journalists and publishing media houses. Strangely, my media colleagues, those in the Editors Guild and Kenya Union of Journalists, have kept quiet, those who in office. I don't know, for some silent, some strange reasons, they're either in bed with government or have decided to see no evil or hear no evil. But it will have very serious impact on the practice of journalism and publishing of content. What would a police person know about what should be published, how to publish the stories on victims of terror, and how will the world know that they...
That was David Ohito, the digital editor at the Standard Media Group. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Nairobi. The international humanitarian group called CARE released a new report highlighting the dire consequences of South Sudan's poor healthcare infrastructure. It argues that strengthening local health systems should be the focus of all humanitarian health interventions. Mugomi Davis Rakarinji has more for VOA from Juba.
The report says the one-year-old conflict has worsened the already fragile healthcare system in the country. It focused on the three states mostly heavily affected by the year-long conflict: Jonglei, Unity, and Upper Nile. The CARE report estimates that even before the crisis began, one in seven mothers died from pregnancy and birth-related complications in South Sudan. Less than 5% of South Sudanese women utilize antenatal care, and 80% of women give birth at home. But this past year, even more women died due to the impact of the conflict, because fewer medical personnel were able to attend childbirth, and basic medications are hard to find. Grace Saita, health advisor for CARE South Sudan, co-authored the report.
Most of these maternal deaths are due to factors that can actually be prevented. One of it is complicated deliveries that require emergency operations like cesarean sections, and which is not then available. Then severe bleeding. After delivery, women normally experience a loss of blood, which is minimal, but in our case, we find that hemorrhages really contribute to the deaths of the mothers.
According to the National Bureau of Statistics 2013 report, nearly 2,000 women die for every 100,000 live births in South Sudan. South Sudan has one of the highest infant mortality rates in the world. She says many infants would be saved if their mothers were supported by skilled medical personnel during childbirth.
We have also high neonatal mortality rates in this country. And in the sense that we are not able to resuscitate children, and especially where we have children being born at home and we are not able to do resuscitation, we end up losing many of our children during the first neonatal life, that is the first 28 days of birth, and still due to infections.
Saita says many women give birth at home simply because there are no nearby facilities to attend to them. Others do not visit hospitals due in part to traditional beliefs. And still others fear being mistreated by medical staff. Chol Majok Chol, a clinic officer working at Manyagar, Twitch East County in Jonglei State, says he's always overwhelmed by the number of patients coming in for treatment.
We have these challenges of having no space for mothers to deliver. The facilities that you can see now are very small, and they're supposed to meet the standard of having a primary health care center and units. We normally combine mothers and children, men and women, of different medical problems.
Chol says the facility he works for is severely understaffed. He says he typically attends to about 200 patients a day. Many health facilities were destroyed and medicine looted during the first days of the conflict. Overall, There are nearly 37 hospitals in South Sudan, serving an estimated 11 million people. The report also says because of the conflict, many diseases have increased, such as deadly Kala-Azar and diarrhea diseases, and acute respiratory tract infections caused by sleeping out in the open. For VOA News, I am Mugumedev Surakarinj in Juba.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, December 14th. Africa's two clubs in this year's FIFA Club World Cup have been eliminated from the title quest. African champion AS Setif of Algeria and the Moroccan club Maghreb Tetouan were both defeated by the same team, Auckland City, the Oceanian champion. On Saturday, the New Zealand club beat AS Setif 1-0 to reach the semi-finals for the first time. John Arvin's second-half strike gave his club a stunning North African double. Auckland City, which is making a record sixth appearance at the tournament, had beaten Moroccan club Maghreb Tetouan on penalties in their preliminary round clash on Wednesday. Auckland will now face San Lorenzo of Argentina, the South American champion, in a semi-final in Marrakech on Wednesday. The FIFA Club World Cup is contested annually by continental champions, plus the host nation's national champion. Morocco is hosting the tournament for the second year running, on the basis of which Maghreb Tetouan qualified to play. The Moroccan club's defeat has already forced its coach, Aziz El Amri, to resign. Amri, who is 64, stepped down 3 days after Tetouan lost on penalties to Auckland City in a quarter-final playoff. Tetouan failed to match the performance of fellow Moroccan club Raja Casablanca, which went all the way to the final of the tournament when Morocco hosted the FIFA Club World Cup last year. Raja lost 2-0 to German club Bayern Munich in the final of last year's competition. Let's recall that in 2010, another African team, TP Mazembe of the Democratic Republic of Congo, made it all the way to the final, where it lost by 3 goals to Italian giant Inter Milan. Now, all the 7 participants in the ongoing FIFA Club World Cup will return home with some prize money. The winner gets $5 million, runner-up $4 million, and the third place winner $2.5 million. Also, the team that finishes fourth gets $2 million, fifth place $1.5 million, sixth place $1 million, and the last $500,000. Turning to the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations, one of the 16 finalists, Cameroon, will begin its preparations for the tournament with a squad get together in Yaoundé on January 5th, according to official sources. The Indomitable Lions will spend 3 days training in the capital and will also take on the Democratic Republic of Congo in a friendly. The team will then move on to Libreville in Gabon for another training camp from January 8th to 16th. The 2015 Africa Cup of Nations, which will be the 30th edition of the 2-yearly football extravaganza, will run from January 17th to February 8th in Equatorial Guinea. Cameroon is in Group D of the tournament, where it will face Mali on January 20th, Guinea on January 24th, and the Ivory Coast on January 28th. The Indomitable Lions will play all their first-round games in Equatorial Guinea's capital, Malabo. Equatorial Guinea was picked as hosts after Morocco backed out due to Ebola fears. Meanwhile, retired Indomitable Lions star Samuel Eto'o may have his 12-month contract at English Premiership club Everton extended. His agents will be in England over Christmas to hold talks. The deal signed by the striker upon his arrival at Everton as a free agent over the summer included a clause which can be activated once he has completed 15 games. With the Cameroon international having shown that he can be an important figure in Everton's plans, with 4 goals and 2 assists in his 15 appearances in all competitions, all sides are now keen to gather at the negotiating table.
Roberto Martinez has previously admitted that he would like to keep the 33-year-old past the end of the current campaign. In October, the Spaniard said, quote, "It's natural he will get another year," unquote. There are now only a few formalities left to be tied up. The former Barcelona star has scored 4 goals in 14 appearances spread across Premier League, Europa League, and League Cup competition. In other news, Liverpool striker Mario Balotelli has accepted a charge of making racist and anti-Semitic comments on social media. The charge was made by the English Football Association. Balotelli was charged a week ago after he posted a controversial image of computer game character Super Mario on Instagram. The image included the message, "Don't be racist, be like Mario. He's an Italian plumber created by Japanese people who speaks English and looks like a Mexican, jumps like a black man, and grabs coin like a Jew." Balotelli's offense was deemed by the FA to be an aggravated breach, as it included a reference to ethnic origin, color, race, nationality, or religion. The 24-year-old has not requested a personal hearing, but has instead submitted written mitigation in the hope of persuading the FA to give him a fine instead of a suspension. The minimum ban for a race-related on-pitch offense is 5 matches, but that would not apply in a case such as Balotelli's, for which no specific punishments are outlined. The player apologized for the posting last week, writing on Twitter, "I apologize if I've offended anyone. The post was meant to be anti-racist with humor. I now understand that out of context, it may have the opposite effect." Balotelli deleted the offensive post after it was criticized. But according to FA guidelines, deleting an inappropriate posting, while advisable, does not necessarily prevent disciplinary action being taken. Finally, Philippine boxing legend Manny Pacquiao vowed to chase Floyd Mayweather into ring submission after his U.S. rival offered to fight him next year in the blockbuster world title face-off. Pacquiao, who is 36, says Mayweather has reached a dead end and he has nowhere to run but to fight him. He spoke to the French news agency AFP on Saturday, hours after the undefeated Mayweather issued the May 2nd challenge on U.S. television. The two were longtime rivals as the best pound-for-pound boxers of their generation. But the dream fight has never materialized to the disappointment of the boxing world. Speaking to Showtime Sports in the U.S. on Friday night, Mayweather, who is 37, said he wants his next fight to be against the Filipino star. However, the American said the expected richest fight in boxing history will only happen if he receives a much bigger share of the purse than his opponent. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Yeah, we get hope, say one day we go make them. We were not born with money, less opportunity, still we want me some company. In all these days, we not pop up in. Oh, my year we took out some support, but not this time we from poor. We have been to one day show, and the entire world go know, say. Number one, we born up and body. The game where we play na both giddy. We na be na PCC and go me. Fufu so far for them beat Benny. We na bubble pain. When I kill lick me guinea guinea. Barry then shine like robbery. Don't knock me one come Gary. One word the boy know the hairy. We na bubble pain. Off to school with me khaki. They fight from Kissy to 40. University pass you go read. No easy, for leave like bubble pain. I remember the time for the kitty kitty. Some of free run go Gambia and Guinea. The thing we I see not be lily. Some see don't waste Maxwell Kobe. Yes, original bubble pain. We not 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 bubble pain. We will not bomb it money. Less opportunity. Still, you want me some for this. fall. Like when them put the load up and soul. Now so we won't meet the wall. One day we go stand tall.
Hear this. Oh, say man don't swim, I don't swim, I don't tire. Every day think they want like a fire. But still I man get for beer. Though they brought and they make I don't skia. They just left with a sweet for the soul. For all this skin, way out skin. But still man they swing. He make a decide for change to run again. Cause for all the work man don't see no gain. Man don't dry leg in, don't left so sobbing. But me now go pain and not go run away. He too bad, so struggle. And the struggle every day, he they double. Now so we go dive on the struggle. The system too hard, now they juggle. But I don't will life just a tangle. Not so, if I be you. Not so, I be follow. Now the system, now he make a try so. And the phone make a jump for Bolipo. But me now go pain, no say, I don't ever.
Yeah, yeah.
We now go for pain. Pay tax for love, double tax back for sneeze. You know easy I know, but we there for our pain. From Monday to Friday, we defend the money. Forget for questioning, massive for daddy God forgive. We there for our pain, society where we belong. Full of enemies among, we survive, care for the strong. Can't join, sing the song, yes, like for our pain.
Every one of we get similar stories, but at the same time, we work hard, we go make them, yeah?
We not bubble pain.
Hello.
Metro Studio Internationale, Saidi Komore Mwana Komoro, Ali Choki Mzee Kujinafasi, Frem Joshua, Toto ya Mwanza, Papa Musofe.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. It appears that the stage is now set for the most exciting and closest presidential election in Nigeria on 14th February 2015. Last Thursday, the governing People's Democratic Party, PDP, met at its convention in Abuja and in a primary election confirmed that the sole candidate, the incumbent president, Goodluck Jonathan, would be its flag bearer for the 2015 elections. On the same day, the All Progressive Congress, APC, concluded its two-day convention in the Testing Bulagun Stadium in Surulere, Lagos, when, in a primary vote, it decided that Major General Muhammadu Buhari, retired, would be its presidential candidate. The 71-year-old general received an overwhelming endorsement of over 3,000 votes, with his nearest rival, former Vice President Atiku Abubakar, receiving 954 votes. All the contestants accepted the election results for Buhari. General Buhari has a strong grassroots support, primarily for the part he played in his 20-month rule as head of state of Nigeria. He is known for his opposition to indiscipline and corruption in Nigeria. He has played a constructive role in the building up of the oil industry in Nigeria. Yet, he is counted as one of the few Nigerian politicians that cannot be accused of corruption. After his election by the APC as the presidential candidate, he asserted that his priority would be agriculture, health care, and creation of wealth. General Buhari has previously contested the presidential elections. He lost to former President Olusegun Obasanjo, Yar'Adua, and President Goodluck Jonathan, who won the 2011 election with 57% of the votes to 32% for Buhari. So what is the difference this election cycle in 2015? In the first place, the PDP has been plagued in the past few months with very deep divisions. Some governors left the party, as well as the crossing of the carpet by politicians from the PDP to the APC. Recently, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, who left the PDP to join the APC was blocked from entering the chamber by armed policemen. President Goodluck Jonathan has been much criticized for a whole array of problems, including the government's inability to end the Boko Haram insurgency and the failure to rescue the April 2014 kidnapping of the Chibok girls. Recently, owing to the drop of the Brent crude oil price from $100 a barrel to $60, the Nigerian economy, with its dependence on oil, is now under stress. General Buhari has always been seen as a man with a firm hand. Although he is often called a dictator, others have mistakenly referred to him as a Muslim extremist from the north, and as a man who has lost 3 previous presidential elections, is vulnerable to the charge that he is a loser. But there is a difference now. He is now widely seen as someone who could successfully take on Boko Haram and end rampant corruption in Nigerian politics. He now enjoys strong support from Western Nigeria and some support from the East and part of the country. A problem for him and the APC could be that the Boko Haram insurgency in some states in the north could reduce the votes from the north, where the APC has its greatest strength. The selection of running mates or vice presidential candidates could always be problematical in Nigeria because it could affect the vote count in the election. President Goodluck Jonathan has already decided to follow continuity and opted to maintain the current Vice President Namandi Sambo, who is also from the north and a Muslim. The preferred choice of a vice presidential candidate for General Buhari has been the very popular former Lagos State Governor, Babatunde Fashola. But he is also a Muslim as Buhari. To balance the ticket, General Buhari might be compelled or obliged to select a Christian APC member from the south. The coming months may present significant challenges for Nigeria, Africa's most prosperous country. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And that was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Shegun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Brian Makulie, we say thanks for joining us. And as the elders in Nigeria say, if a man wants to grow a long tooth, he should have the lip to cover it. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Much has changed in the 3 decades since HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, was identified.
Even as recently as a decade ago, a diagnosis of HIV/AIDS seemed like a death sentence for an entire continent, said Secretary of State John Kerry. Back then, more than 2 million people died from AIDS-related causes on a worldwide basis. Today, we've cut those numbers by 34%. Back then, AIDS threatened to wipe out a whole generation, leaving behind 14 million orphans and vulnerable children. Today, we've slashed new infections among children in half. The tide has turned, said Secretary Kerry. We are fighting the disease, and an AIDS-free generation is in sight.
PEPFAR is now supporting life-saving antiretroviral drug treatment for 7.7 million men, women, and children. We're providing HIV testing and counseling to more than 14 million pregnant women. We're training more than 140,000 new healthcare workers to deliver HIV and other health-related services in AIDS-affected countries.
But the battle is not yet won, said Secretary Kerry. So the United States is intensifying the fight against this terrible disease and introducing new strategies. First, PEPFAR is collaborating with the Nike Foundation and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in a $210 million public-private partnership to achieve an AIDS-free future for adolescent girls and young women in up to 10 countries. Second, we will invest $116.5 million to strengthen the capacity of health workers to deliver life-saving HIV services and also help address other public health threats across Africa. Third, through the Accelerating Children's HIV/AIDS Treatment Initiative, PEPFAR, and the Children's Investment Fund Foundation, over the next 2 years, we will double the total number of children receiving life-saving antiretroviral treatment across 10 countries in sub-Saharan Africa. We are also working with our partners to accelerate the development of new pediatric medicines. Fourth, PEPFAR and the Millennium Challenge Corporation are partnering to invest $21.5 million toward creating country-driven local data hubs that will include data critical to controlling the epidemic, including health, poverty, and gender data, and will be used to improve strategic planning and quality of care. The United States' commitment to combating HIV/AIDS through PEPFAR and our long-standing support of the Global Fund is as undiminished as our work is unfinished. We can achieve an AIDS-free generation, said Secretary Kerry.